So what is the unemployment situation in Australia?
Well, Australia currently has had persistently high unemployment for the last 28 or 29 years. Prior to that and after the Second World War, up until about the mid-1970s, we had very low unemployment, below 2%, like most Western countries. And governments would be thrown out of office if unemployment went above 2%. In 1974-75, the unemployment rate started to rise and went up to 11% in that period. And it's never really come down below those sort of levels until very recently, and it's now around about 6%. But what's been happening is in 1991, like in Europe and elsewhere, there was a very large recession, and unemployment went back up to 12-13%. And as it came down through the 1990s, relatively slowly, what's emerged is that this phenomenon we call underemployment, which means that firms during that 1991 recession shook out a lot of full-time jobs and replaced them with part-time jobs. And as the economy started growing again, the jobs growth was expressed in increasing proportions of part-time work. And so we now have this dual phenomenon of persistent, what I call persistently high unemployment, which the government of the day calls full employment, and that means about 6% unemployment rate. Adding to that around 6% underemployment of people who have jobs but who are unable to get enough work.
No, the definition of being employed in Australia.
Well, we follow the International Labour Organization, the ILO, definitions. And so the statistician considers a person employed if they've been working for 1 hour per week in the particular week that the survey is asked. So, yeah, the difference between being officially unemployed and being officially employed is 1 hour of work.
Which is not much. So then you have made your own measure of what you call underemployment. Can you explain that?
Well, my research centre, COFFEE, has our what we call our COFFEE labour market indicators, and to get a broader measure of labour underutilisation, which is what we term it, we've worked out a way of combining the official unemployment rate, which is about 6%, and we combine that with measures of the foregone hours that emerge from people not being able to get as many hours work per week as they would want because there's not enough hours provided by the employers. And we add them together with another component of labour wastage, which we call hidden unemployment. And these are people who are officially considered outside the labour force measure by the statistician because they are not actively looking for work, but who would want to be working if there were jobs available. And we add them all together, and our current measure in February 2004, which is the last time that data was available to do this, gives you a total underutilisation rate of about 12.5%.
Are any of your economics colleagues contesting this way of measuring underutilisation of labour?
Well, most people have to acknowledge that it's broader than the official unemployment rate. The orthodoxy, which we might, for the rest of this discussion, term neoliberals, the neoliberals do contest it because, A, they deny that there's significant underemployment because they have a ideological motivation to consider part-time work a freely chosen state. So they say that part-time workers are emerged in Western societies, Western economies, in reference to the desire by workers to be more flexible. And so they want to deny that it's really a replacement of full-time work because it's a rationing mechanism on the economy. They also want to deny that the import of hidden unemployment. These are people who, when the central statistician has asked them whether they would like work, they've said yes. And in the second question, have you actively sought work, they say no. And so they're classified as not being in the labour force, and so therefore they're not officially unemployed. The neoliberals want to consider these people not really willing to work under any circumstances, and so they would say they don't really exist.
Can you say anything about what loss you have for society when, in your view, you have an underutilization of labour of around 12%?
Well, I mean, there's various ways of conceiving or measuring the concept of loss. I mean, even in the most blatant terms that should be understood by every economist and every politician of any persuasion, political persuasion, that is, you've just got the sheer output loss. And we tend to erroneously equate welfare with material production. And so for people of that ilk, if you've got 12.5% of your willing labour resources sitting around essentially not producing, then you've got massive loss of output. And in Australia, that could be something like 3% of current GDP. But of course, more sophisticated analysts want to broaden the measure of loss to include all of the intangibles relating to, you know, what we might consider to be social losses, which we might consider to be loss of self-esteem, loss of social continuity, social cohesion, loss of skills, loss of skill development. So not only do you lose your current skills, but you don't participate in ongoing skill accumulation, which typically happens within workforces. We know that those factors combine to create increased crime rates in high areas of unemployment, increased family breakdowns, youth suicide, a whole range of other difficult to measure but clearly related costs, which all add together to be something that you can't believe politicians would allow. Economists, the neoliberals, seem obsessed with microeconomic efficiency and reform and restructuring, and the losses involved there are rather trivial, or the gains that might be gained are rather trivial when you see the daily wastage resulting from such massive losses of unemployment.
You have also on your website, on the coffee website, you have this little fairy tale about dogs and bones. Can you explain that?
This is what every parent should tell their children before they go to sleep at night, because if the current governments that run most of our countries have any way, this will be the children's future. And this is a story that basically says, let's take 100 dogs and we'll amass them in some yard and we'll bury 94 bones in a field, and we release the 100 dogs. And they chase out into the field, and at least 6 dogs are going to come home that evening without a bone. That's at least 6%. It happens to be the unemployment rate. And of course, we might, if we're neoliberals and we're obsessed with supply side explanations for this phenomenon, we might take the at least six who didn't get a dog, and we'll give them didn't get a bone. Sorry. And we'll give them psychological counselling, so, because they mustn't be working, looking hard enough. We'll give them some training in bone retrieval. And, of course, we'll then set the same 100 dogs off next day. And, of course, 6 will not come back. At least 6 won't come back with a bone. And probably will be a different 6 now, because we've revved the other ones up and increased their skills. And, of course, you know, we could keep going on and on doing that until we finally work out that if we bury 100 bones, we've got a pretty good chance of each of them coming back with a bone.
But this is a fairy tale, but you can't relate this to real figures in the Australian economy if you compare the number of people wanting jobs,
yeah,
as opposed compared to the number of jobs that are announced in the papers, etc.
Yeah, I mean, economists talk about the unemployment vacancy ratio. So that's, as Tron said, the number of people who are wanting work against the number of unfilled vacancies that are posted coinciding. And, well, since 1974 in Australia, the average UV ratio, the average number of unemployed per unfilled vacancy, has been around 11. It's currently about 6. So you've got a problem if you're saying people are unemployed because they're not searching hard enough or they're not motivated to work. You've got a real problem, and I capture that problem by saying the unemployed can't search for jobs that aren't there. And it's a fallacy of composition to say that if everyone searches hard, everyone will get a job, because currently in Australia there are 6 unemployed people per unfilled vacancy.
How was it before the 70s?
There were more vacancies than unemployed.
And this is a statistical fact?
A statistical fact. In all of the fully employed Western economies, which was most of them, they all took a commitment after the war because they didn't want to go back to the Depression 1930s period where there was very high unemployment. The war, of course, solved that because of the heavy armament spending, to the heavy people joined the army, what have you. And all of the major Western governments after the war in the 1940s did not want to go back to the 1930s. They took a commitment to make sure there were enough jobs available, and the data says it. There were more vacancies than unemployed.
So then you guys in COFFI have come up with the concept of what you call a job guarantee. Can you explain?
Well, essentially, the job guarantee is a simple idea with a lot of weight behind it. It's rather sophisticated idea, which has a very simple explanation. Essentially what it says, and some other people have called it the employer of last resort approach, I tend not to use that terminology because it sort of sounds desperate. It's approaching a desperate problem, that's true, unemployment, but essentially the job guarantee says that the government, the fiscal authority, in our case the federal government, if you've only got one government, then the government, the currency issuing government is the terminology I would use, has a responsibility under United Nations covenants that they all signed in various periods in post-war period to provide enough jobs for all of those who in their domain who want them. And the job guarantee says that if there's the government of the day, the federal government, has to stand ready to provide an unlimited demand for labour who want these jobs at a minimum wage defined by our judicial system whenever a person wants the job.
Okay, so say that I'm living in regional Australia in a little town with very few jobs, and perhaps also a town that has increasing problems because different firms are closing, and I don't want to move to a big city. Then, under your job guarantee system, the government has to give me a job at
the minimum wage. You'd go to the job guarantee office, and you would be given a job in some community development exercise under this scheme.
Can I then stay there in a...
You could have a job guarantee job forever if you wanted to. I mean, a lot of people who become unemployed previously working in the private sector would see a job guarantee as a temporary solution to maintain income stability. But some people might see that the serving the community in these sort of work was very desirable. Mm. Others would see the job guarantee as a test of their skill levels, and that would be a suitable job. Now I go back to the post-war period, and there's a lot of myths about the post-war period, but the fact remains is that the private sector in Australia and elsewhere has never employed enough people to provide enough jobs. So who used to employ them? While the public sector also had a lot of jobs in education and what I would call mainstream public sector work, which competes with the private sector at market wages. But in Australia and elsewhere, there was a small component of work which was an implicit job guarantee. And I often use the example that affected in my early life, the Spencer Street in Melbourne goods yards, the rail loading yards, where anybody could go down to the timekeeper's office, the main office there, any morning you liked, and get a job loading the goods yards or doing some job around the goods yards at the minimum wage. Now, a lot of people went through those jobs in those days, and some of them were like me, who didn't see that as my future, and I've become a professor of economics. Others went into those jobs and then took subsidiary training schemes offered by the railways to become, move up into the railways. So they became goods checkers, and then they moved into office work or supervisory work. And there's others who probably would have always been loading the goods yards because of their motivation or their skill levels or other reasons. And so the fact that these jobs were provided for a whole range of different people with different life fortunes is very important because we all had a single need at that time, and that was to have an income.
So in reality, before the mid-70s, there was a job guarantee.
It was implicit. There was a range of government areas, and I just used one, the rail system.
You could just go and get that job somewhere.
There were jobs everywhere, local councils, you could always get a job. And that's how we maintain full employment. And so what we're advocating is we actually make that capacity of the public sector explicit, we formalise it, and therefore go back to a full employment system that we had previously.
There is an interesting point here, because you are saying that, okay, on one hand, your right is to get a job anywhere at any time if you are unemployed. On the other hand, the wage level is set by someone else and you don't have any influence over the wage level. And then I want to ask you about how you originally got this idea, and you have the rule system in Australia. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I mean, the mistake that a lot of people make when they hear the story about the job guarantee is that they believe it's a job creation system. And it is in part, that's a component of it, but it's actually a system of full employment with price stability. And what I mean by that is inherent in it is an anchoring system to make sure that you can move to a fully employed state without encouraging an inflationary spiral. Now, one of the problems that your listeners may be familiar with sort of Keynesian remedies, and these are crudely that the government might maintain higher employment levels, if not full employment levels, by spending and spending in various areas of the economy and therefore encouraging more employment, because we know that employment is driven by spending. Now, the problem with that type of approach is that it's untargeted spending and it relies on purchasing things at market prices. And so if there is an inflationary tendency or bias in the system and you're buying things at market prices, then you're competing in the market with everybody else, and you will, you know, stimulate whatever inflationary bias there is in the system. But moreover, you obviously can't target regional areas in this way. That's a separate story. So getting back to this market price competition argument, the job guarantee is unique because it hires labour off the bottom rather than the top of the market. So the government could go in and hire all these people in the sort of mainstream, using the previous terminology, public sector at market prices. But all it will do is stimulate whatever market pressures there are. And one of the reasons why full employment has become so unpopular is because of the fear of inflation that occurred following the OPEC oil price rises throughout the world in the mid-70s. And people have got completely the wrong impression of what happened there, and they believed it was because there was too much government spending, whereas it was, you know, just a major cost supply shock which should have been dealt with in a different way. But the story of the job guarantee is that you will never create inflation with a job guarantee because you're hiring at a fixed price.
That you decide,
that you set. It's at the bottom of the private sector wage structure, so you're not competing for labour out of the private sector. What you're saying is if you can't get a job in the private sector or in the mainstream public sector at market wages for whatever reason, then we'll give you a job at the bottom of the wage structure.
But you can't strike or fight for a higher wage if you have a job guaranteed job, but you can quit the job and get a better job in private sector.
That's true.
But I asked you about the rule. Yeah.
Well, the idea of the job guarantee came to me when I was a university student back in the late 1970s. And in Australia, of course, we had the first period of high unemployment starting about 1975. And by 1978, it was sort of becoming entrenched. And I was a student doing at Melbourne University, and I was studying at that time as one of my components of my fourth year, agricultural economics. And one of the topics of that time was the famous wool price stabilisation scheme that was in vogue, was a government-sponsored scheme to stabilise income of farmers. And the way it worked was that the farmers would bring all of their wool bales to the market each whatever period, and any wool that wasn't demanded by the wool buyers, the government would buy at the agreed price.
Which was fairly low, but they will buy
it. That was one of the problems with it. It was actually a high price.
Okay.
Because the agreed price was the outcome of lobbying by all the rural sector.
Okay.
And, of course, the rural sector were trying to push the income up of the farmers beyond which the market could bear.
Okay.
And that became its death knell. But the point was that any wool at any period that wasn't in demand by the private markets, the government would buy up and put it into big wool stores. And any time that the private sector was demanding more than was currently delivered to the market, the government would release it from the wool stores to make sure the market didn't inflate.
Okay.
And so I sat in this lecture and I wasn't particularly interested in wool, but I said to myself, this is a full employment scheme for wool. And so I set about then working out that you could have the same mechanics operating where the government could buy all of the unwanted labour, unwanted by the market, and when the market wanted more labour, it could just release that labour whenever it wanted to.
Because so people sort of quit their low-paid job,
go into the private sector
and get better payment in the private sector.
So the private sector were only bidding labour away from this buffer stock, and they used to use the term in agricultural markets, buffer stocks of agricultural products. And that's what the wool price scheme was. It created a buffer stock that could be relinquished at any time when the private market was burning hot.
But then this job guarantee system will be a buffer which will cycle with the business cycle then?
That's true.
Explain.
Well, I mean, when say we have a very... The business sector is not optimistic about for whatever reason, and they go through cycles of waves of optimism. So they stop investing for a time, and there's a downturn in product demand, and unemployment rises. It's a typical cycle. Well, under our current system, those people become unemployed. In the job guarantee system, those people, if they wanted to, would go and get a job in and the buffer stock of jobs would then rise. And, of course, when the private sector started to feel good again, and they start investing again, and new firms come into, the old firms get crunched in the recession or the downturn, well, then the private sector is just bidding away workers from the buffer stock. So it goes up and down with the sentiments of the waves of optimism and pessimism in the private sector.
And then the workers in the job guarantee scheme, they wouldn't have any compunction against sort of quitting because they know that they can go back any time they want?
Well, most would probably prefer to work in the private sector.
I think
some mightn't, because some people might be, you know, inspired to work on community development schemes at low wages. But I think, you know, your average is, there's this term, this aspiring family these days. You know, the average aspiring family prefers a minimum income to no income, but prefers higher income to minimum income.
Okay, but some critical questions, and one is, of course, the minimum wage in Australia is how much?
Currently around $481 a week.
Yeah, and if you were a dictator in Australia, where would you put the minimum wage for a job guarantee job?
Okay, so I mean the question is, where do you want to set the job guarantee wage? Now, I would set it higher. I would raise the minimum wage in Australia and use, because the job guarantee wage can also be construed as an industry policy, because there's currently a whole range of low technology, high cost, private sector operations out there producing nothing of particular worth, and so I would drive them out of business by putting the minimum wage above the minimum currently offered by the worst of the private sector. But that's a personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing in the job guarantee system that says you have to set the minimum wage at anything. I would have it higher than currently is in Australia. Not much higher, but higher.
$600?
Well, you know, the figure's irrelevant. I'd have it at some figure higher But that's a matter of choice.
But it must be a level that people can survive on.
Well, it effectively becomes the minimum wage of the system. And if you want to be serious about having a population, you don't want to create a compulsory workforce where you're not giving them a living wage. It has to be a reasonable living wage, and of course there's a huge debate upon what that is.
Another critical question is, of course, let's go back to this regional town with nothing much to do and a lot of people who are wanting jobs, and should they just in the job guarantee system sit around and paint rocks or dig holes in the ground and fill them up again, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge discussion about the concept of a real job and a fake job, and it's become almost offensive that what is a real job. And well, I mean, the issue hasn't been helped by the sort of historical Keynesian literature, because, you know, the Keynesians used to say it was better to just go and bury money in the fields than have people, and for people then to go and dig it up, than to have them lying idle doing nothing. Well, it probably is better, but more creatively, there's a whole, I would say an infinite number, but let's say a very large number, to suppress my idealism. There's a very large number of things that the private sector, activities that the private sector will never engage in because they won't yield private profits, but which will yield social profits or social benefits.
Give examples.
Well, in Australia, for example, there's an aged care crisis. And the aged care crisis is that there's a rising number of people who are becoming older who are being forced into public aged care accommodation or private aged care accommodation. And there's not enough aged care accommodation being provided. The question arises is why do people leave their homes when they get older and go into institutional care? And the answer when the surveys are done is that there's a whole range of reasons, but many of them include not able to do their own shopping, not able to maintain their houses, paint the boards and fix the garden, not able to wash their clothes any longer, those sort of things. Mm-hmm. Well, I see a whole range of jobs immediately before my eyes.
Home helpers,
lawnmower people, shoppers. Mm-hmm. And I think if you think a bit laterally, even in the current ideas of what is a gainful employment, I think if you think a bit laterally, you can see a whole range of activities. Another in this area that we're talking now, the Hunter region of New South Wales, Australia, there's a massive resource called the Hunter River. And the Hunter River is a fishing resource and a tourist resort, but it's dying because of the farming practices on its shoreline, and it's becoming the river's dying.
Polluted by nitrogen and that.
Yeah,
kind of stuff.
all of the ecological problems that are occurring in waterways around the world. Now, the clean-up of the Hunter River along the banks and around the area, which would improve its amenity and increase its vitality, are labour-intensive, low-skilled jobs. Now, they're job guarantee jobs. Perfect.
But as long as these job guarantee jobs are what we earlier called a buffer stock, all these jobs that we are talking about in the job guarantee system must be jobs that are there in the job bank, but they are not necessarily the type of jobs that need to be done here and now. But they are available when people want a job guaranteed job. So every community then must have a sort of bank of jobs that we would like done, but which we sort of can survive without for the time being.
Well, I think there's some misconception on that, and I think our thinking has evolved in this area. The way I look at it is this: that for a given amount of private sector spending and therefore a certain amount of private jobs that are generated, you then add whatever the current political position of the government is of the day. So if you've got a very social democratic, the old-fashioned social democratic style government, you have quite a solid commitment to a lot of public sector work. If you've got a neoliberal government like Australia has got, for example, now, you will have a less commitment to public mainstream public jobs. So whatever current economic policy is, you will have a certain size job guarantee required if you're serious about full employment. So that's relatively predictable. That doesn't change rapidly, that sort of political position. What does change more quickly is private sector sentiment. So what I'm projecting here is that for a given political philosophy, you have a core sort of job guarantee component, and around that you'll have a more transitory component. Now, if you've got a social democratic styled government with a large commitment to public sector employment, your core job guarantee will be very low, even zero. And so then you'll just have jobs that will be relatively transitory. Whereas if you've got a neoliberal type government, you could still have a job guarantee and you'll have a rather larger core, and therefore the types of jobs that might be, and a more slowly changing job guarantee pool. And so therefore the sort of jobs that would be applicable there could be more longer term jobs.
A question is, I mean, for example, you say sort of helping the pensioners at home so they can stay at home longer. And there are countries, for example, my own country, Norway, where you have people with professional jobs coming home to elderly people and helping them out. So then there is a potential conflict between the unions and the job guarantee scheme, because the unions will say what will happen is that councils who don't have much money will try to exploit the job guarantee to get things done cheaper, and ordinary, better-paid jobs will lose out.
Well, I mean, again, remember that this is a federally funded scheme, and so I'm not sure why the funding goes to anybody within any area who needs a job. So in Australian system, it's not contingent on what local government funding would be, for example, because it's not local government funds that would be used here, it's federal funds.
Yes, but wouldn't local government hold back in creating new permanent jobs?
Well, I mean, okay, there is a danger that you will get some substitution operating. But I think all systems and all policies have issues that need scrutiny. And I think that, you know, if you've got a history of some local area, say a local government authority, running childcare centres, and suddenly it stops running childcare centres and puts these jobs into the job guarantee pool, well, I think you would just stop. That would have to be regulated. I think, like any policy, you need regulation, and I think there's always going to be entities within the economy or the community trying to work out ways to get around the policy. That's life.
But I expect you have been talking to Australian unions about this, because you know that could be a problem.
Well, the Australian unions have initially resented it, and now they support it. So we've got support from all the major unions. The ACTU is the Australian Council of Trade Unions, which is the peak body. They are very sympathetic to this, and they're sympathetic for two reasons. One, because they do believe that with appropriate policy design and appropriate administrative machinery, you can regulate it so it doesn't become abused. But B, rather strategically, you've got a situation in Australia where you've got trade union coverage in, say, the early 1970s around 54%. It's now about 18 or 19%. You've got trade unions falling away in service sector, the growing service sector. The trade unions are heading for extinction. And so trade unions can see that if they support a job guarantee, then you've got here a pool of workers who would become trade union members.
And would you then imagine that people on a job guarantee would be trade union members still?
Well, I think that's a personal choice. I mean, they could, or they might, or they might not. But at the moment, as unemployed people, they're not union members either. Mm. And if the union gives them some income security, well, then supports a scheme that gives them income security, maybe they would join.
Wouldn't, seen from the position of the unions, wouldn't also the issue of workers knowing that regardless of what happens to me in this capitalist system, there is some sort of basic safety net, which is the job guarantee, wouldn't that give the workers an edge in their balance of power with the capitalists?
Well, a lot of people on the, let's call it the left side of the debate, who would ordinarily be my allies, are very critical of the job guarantee, because they argue, that's one of their arguments, that it basically will be, ultimately will empower the workers too much, and no government would tolerate a system where the workers are that empowered. I actually, and what they're really harking back to are sort of famous discussions in the sort of early 40s, and there's one famous article by a Polish economist called Michael Kolesky, The Political Aspects of Full Employment, who said that the capitalist classes will always oppose full employment because it makes the workers too bolshy. It gives them too much.
Too bolshy?
Bolshy.
Which means?
It's an Australian term. It gives them too much power.
Bolshevik?
Yeah. It makes them too aggressively anti the capitalist.
Okay.
Sorry for that. Now, I have a different opinion on that. I because, first of all, I distinguish the job guarantee from full employment at market wages. I call it loose full employment, because there's a component that are not that at the minimum wage, that the anchor wage, which effectively becomes the minimum or the floor in the economy. And what I basically think is that the employers will, once they get over their fear and loathing of government activity, which they certainly have in Australian economy, unless it's subsidising their own corporate welfare, but that's another story. I think the bosses and the elites will actually like the job guarantee, because what it will do is regularise, make more regular, and lower their costs of hiring. Because at the moment, when you've got a very strongly growing economy and you've had people who have been long-term unemployed for many years, they're harder to deal with than workers who have maintained a lot of their general skills, we call them, you know, going to work, maintaining a regular pattern of work and attachment to the labour market. I believe, in actual fact, the bosses will see this workforce as more conducive to their interests rather than the unemployed. So I think they would be able to resist wage demands more.
So you're saying then that having people in the job guarantee means that there will be a pool of more employable workers for the private sector?
Definitely.
Yeah, okay.
And so I think the job guarantee pool are more of a threat to the current non-job guarantee workforce than the unemployed are.
I expect some of the listeners would wonder where you shall get all the money for this, etc., and we will come back to that topic, but not yet. I have some further critical questions. If you are on the job guarantee, will you have pay? Will you get your wages when you are sick? Is there a pension system? Will you have regulated holidays, whatever?
Yeah, well, see, we make a clear distinction between a job guarantee and schemes like Workfare, or over here they're called Work for the Dole, or other sort of program type schemes.
Which means that you have to work for getting unemployment.
You get the Dole and you have to do a couple of days' work. It's sort of like a Merchant of Venice payback, you know, Shylock.
Okay.
We call the job guarantee a regular jobs. You can stay in the job guarantee as long as you like. Your wages will grow according to the minimum wage growth. You will have holiday pay, which in Australia is, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 20 days paid annual leave, plus a 7.5% loading on those 20 days. You would have sickness benefits, and they vary depending upon different award wages in different industries. You would have superannuation, or a deferred pension scheme in the United States setting. You would have all of the benefits of normal paid jobs. They're proper full-time, or if you choose to do them part-time, it's your preference, jobs.
Except that everything is by the minimum, on a minimum wage level.
Yeah.
And they can't imagine then that the job guarantee personnel in Australia goes on a strike. They don't get any money then.
Well, if any worker goes on a strike, they don't get any money.
No. And what if some person says that I don't like this system, where I'm sort of commanded to go and do work that I consider meaningless, or whatever, on the job guarantee? I think we should have some sort of system when I simply get a minimum pension or whatever for doing nothing. There's a term for this sort
of... This is called basic income.
Yeah, basic income. And there are people who work for the basic income system in the same way that you guys work for the job guarantee system. Could you comment on the basic income?
Well, I mean, this is another large debate that's going on as to whether you should have income guarantees or work guarantees. And I'm rather a Puritan in the sense that I believe that if it's the government's responsibility to provide work for everybody, then everybody who is capable, that is fit and able, should also reciprocate and work for their living. And
so no one should be able to sit around and...
I don't see that we should replace unemployment with a basic income where you don't have to contribute to it. I think you're just buying people off that way. But I think there's fundamental problems with that type of system, and these are problems of motivation and also problems of inflation. I think under a basic income system, you don't have any check on inflation. And I think the motivation issue is that at the moment, we've talked about it right at the top of the talk about the social costs. There's incredible stigma in economies for being unemployed. Well, all you're doing is going to be transferring that stigma of not contributing onto these people who are basic income recipients. And quite frankly, with the surveys that have been done in Australia of unemployed people, where they've asked them, would you prefer a job or to receive a basic income, the vast majority want to work.
Because people want to contribute in some way.
Yeah, they want to be seen to contribute. Now, in the longer term, I think we've got to broaden as productivity rises and we hopefully broaden the benefits, just the distribution of benefits of technology. And of course we need some cultural and political changes for that. But in the longer term, as there's less need to work and still create the material growth that we seem to hanker after, then we're going to have to broaden our concept of work. Mm. And so I can see in a longer term, things that we currently do not classify as work but classify as leisure will be classified under the job guarantee as work. So you could have someone in, say we live near the Pacific Ocean here, or we could have someone who's surfing being on a job guarantee.
Perhaps teaching kids to surf or whatever, or just surfing.
Or you could have musicians. You know, this could be a way of helping musicians and artists who find it very hard in the market economy to exist. They could become job guarantee musicians, where they could pursue their own creativity and their own art.
But maybe
one day a week they have to rehearse in front of primary school students.
Okay, but there must be some check that they actually are training.
I think there would have to be some contribution, visible contribution, that they are actually playing their music.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is long-term debate.
Okay.
And so in the long term, I think we might get a situation where we can consider someone contributing to the Commonwealth and community welfare without doing what we would normally say today is work.
Hmm. Okay, but then there is a sort of blurred distinction between having a hobby and being on a basic income on one hand, and being on this sort of expanded definition of what a job is.
Well, I think it's a cultural change. I mean, at the moment we have quite a clear conception of what work is and what work isn't.
But in this system, you must have some sort of local bureaucracy all over Australia that checks that people who are on the job guarantee actually shows up and do the work.
Yep. Well, under our current system in Australia, and common in many Western countries, we have welfare systems which regulate the unemployment system, the benefit system, and the regulation of pensions of various types. Well, all we say is, and that's very local in Australia, that's in local towns. Well, what we say is that we don't need that anymore. If you don't have any unemployment benefits, then that bureaucracy becomes the job guarantee bureaucracy.
Okay, but then you said something that's interesting, because we don't have any unemployment benefits. And then you're saying that if you are not disabled or a pensioner or whatever, then you have to be on the job guarantee to get any money from society.
You do. Yeah. Now let's be clear on this. You're talking to me about the job guarantee. Others who believe in a job guarantee, or my American colleagues call it the public sector employment scheme, they have a different view of this, and they say that you could have parallel systems running. You could have a, in other words, they wouldn't say you should be coerced into working. They would say you could have a choice. So acceptance of a job guarantee per se doesn't mean you have to wipe out unemployment benefits. That's a matter of choice. I personally prefer to have people contributing to the community, and I think people want to do that at the moment.
You have one interesting category of long-term unemployed in many countries, also in Australia, are people, let's say, in their late 40s, 50s, who have a lot of experience, but who is considered too old for the private labour market. What sort of contribution could they give in a job guarantee scheme?
Well, you also should add in the at the other end of the labour market, we have very, in Australia and other countries, we have very high youth unemployment. And unlike your country, Norway, where we have sort of, we take care of our youth a bit better, you do, we don't. And we have very high youth rates of unemployment and inactivity, and there's a growing number of people who are neither in formal education or in work. And so here's the two classic ends of the labour market: the totally inexperienced, who have got no work, and the very experienced, who have been shed off by the capitalist system. And so under a job guarantee, you could see that the older workers could be supervisors and mentors and trainers for the younger people who would be developing life skills and actual job skills to take them wherever they would want to go. So I see there being a juxtaposition of great experience and great inexperience.